You're listening to More Than Just an Impression with me, Chris Walker-Thompson. Hello, you're listening to More Than Just an Impression. I'm Chris Walker-Thompson. Thank you so much for your kind words regarding our first episode, and I hope, if you're listening to this, that means that you're sticking around for what other delightful interviews we're going to have. So, my next guest kindly recorded this on Zoom with myself. I did have a technical issue, which meant that my microphone, although wasn't recording on my side, it did record through Zoom, so the quality might differ. But nevertheless, the interview exists. And it's delightful, it's great fun, and it's with a talented individual, someone who you must have heard of, an actor, impressionist, and comedian, whom is renowned for so many different voices in his head, you'd think he was mad. But he isn't, he is just insanely talented, brilliant, and a humble individual whom I'm very grateful in recent years to be able to call him a friend. He's known for playing many different roles, but one particular role we are discussing today is his performance as Nicholas Courtney's the Brigadier Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart from Doctor Who, from the late 60s through to the end of its original run in 89. And here is an example of him in action.
We are going to take the fight to the enemy and make them regret the day they ever came here. The Daleks will rule the day, mark my words.
Companion will be submitted to robotization.
No, I assumed you'd want to see one of our core security measures in practice.
Well, it does sound very effective.
See, your sergeant has an open mind on progress.
Yes, I'm sure you're a shining example to us all, Bentham.
Yes, sir.
So please welcome my next guest, John Coleshaw.
Hello, John. Thank you very much for coming on.
It's a pleasure, Chris. Thank you for inviting me. Always great to talk to you.
Yes, it's been... How have you been coping with the last, 18 months or so?
Yes, it's just a shift of emphasis. Many more remote recordings. Recording the Big Finish dramas and Thunderbirds and what have you from various cupboards around the nation. But still very lucky to have the chance to be creative and just learning what's possible, learning the potential in people's airing cupboards to link up and still record.
So, oh, absolutely.
It's a time of adaptation, but happily things feel as though they are taking some steps a little closer to normality again now. Yeah. Perhaps we can afford to be optimistic, but still careful.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So how's it been doing the remote recordings then with Big Finish? Because I was talking to Jonathan Carley and he said that was how he did the entire War Doctor box set. It was all entirely done remotely.
That really is it. He must have felt that he was at war in a sense with logistics and the sense of technical possibility. These things that you have to push through and use your ingenuity. I usually travel up the road, just a few miles up the road to a studio in Liverpool.
Oh, okay.
Called LA Productions, Liverpool Academy Productions. And I nip into their studio and record it from there, rather than galvanize a cupboard in my room. Because I find that, particularly if I'm doing a number of characters, I find it a bit distracting to check that everything's recorded and everything's at the right level and all of this. I would just rather go to a remote studio and link up that way.
Oh, absolutely.
So that you can just concentrate, so you can have the luxury of just concentrating on the performance. For quicker things, you can just nip into... I've got an old Mark I Ford Granada, and if I shut myself in that and record inside the Ford Granada, the acoustics are pretty good. and it lends a sort of a 1970s sense of acoustic, which is quite good for certain shorter recordings, for short sprints. and yeah. for shorter form things, then those are okay to do at home in the Fort Granada. But for the longer ones, I'm lucky they let me in at the studio up the road.
Oh, lovely. And the big role that you are playing with Big Finish is Brigadier Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart. So how did that come about as such? Because wasn't there some rights issue for quite some time?
Yes, I think all of the characters, they have their they have to be licensed, they have their own ship, and there's all of those protocols to go through. And I think the Big Finish had been talking to the Haysman estate for some time, and I think it was all leading towards that moment when they would say, it's time to do it now, maybe this is the moment to do it. So they were talking through all of those technical and licensing aspects, which are far beyond me. And I think one day, I think Nick Briggs and David Richardson and the team were just thinking about, how do we go about this? How do we go about casting the Brigadier? And I was lucky. They happened to just have a listen to the Five Doctors audio book.
Ah, of course, yes.
One day you and I shall recreate that Troutman Brigadier scene. Maybe we should do it now.
Yes, yeah, certainly.
Never did bother much about rules, not as I remember, Doctor. We'll have to do that in full one time.
We will, yes.
But they listened to that. I got an email very soon after that and was invited to play the Brigadier, which I was over the moon to do.
And because it's been quite a few releases now, they're sort of finding, where can we put you into now? You've turned into the, I'm trying to think of really another comparison, almost like Stan Lee appearing in all the various different comic films, you know. But because you've done, of course, you started with, it was the John Pertwee, the Third Doctor Adventures that they brought you in.
Yes.
Was it, I think it was the Series 5 box set or something, or Volume 5?
Yes, Primord was the first story.
Mm.
And I think that's the thing, that the Brigadier is such an eternal friend of the Doctor, of all the Doctors.
Yes, really.
And I don't think any Doctor's kind of tenure is perhaps complete unless they've met the Brigadier at some point. It's wonderful when it does happen.
Oh,
at some point. And the way that the stories of those Doctors who we haven't seen yet meeting the Brigadier, when you sit down and read those encounters, they're just joyful, and you imagine these moments happening. The theatre of the mind, the theatre of the imagination takes over. And you think, yes, that's exactly how it would have been. And some of the stories, the stranded unit dating story, where the Eighth Doctor, where Paul McGann's Doctor and Brigadier, and they get on very, very well. And you can have those opportunities whereby the Eighth Doctor, with his the depth of his spirit and that charismatic, generous sense, he's a very enigmatic and generous Doctor, I think. And the fact that he says to the Brigadier, "You're a great, great friend to me, and I never thanked you enough. And I'm sorry for my earlier days when I was a bit brusque." Yeah, it's all part of the charm, really. To hear these things said is charming. It's been announced. The Brigadier meets the Ninth Doctor as well.
Yes, I saw that. That's quite exciting. It's Cybermen, I think they also announced as well. Unless that's a
second. Yes, that's it. That's it. And to play the Brigadier alongside the Ninth Doctor, where the Ninth Doctor is, he's following that instinct of that friendship, that long-standing friendship for the Brigadier. It's almost as if travelling to visit an old friend.
Yeah.
You're just craving to see them.
Mm.
Rather like, I don't know, like traveling abroad at Christmas to see an old relative you've not seen for many, many years, but who means a lot to you, is there in your heart. It's like that. And just to hear Christopher Eccleston act with such truth and such immediacy and such heart and such, I mean, it really is an incredible thing.
Absolutely.
And place that friendship of the Brigadier alongside that.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. And I look forward to hopefully many more.
Yeah, of course. Because it's definitely, I'd say we're definitely also the third Doctor adventures. I've always found that each season sort of elevated itself upon its previous, where the first it was a trial to see Tim Treloar do the part and should we have a narration in there? Then they remove that narration, the following one. And of course, then we bring in the Brigadier, they bring in Sergeant Benton comes back, John Levine's in there. And of course, now we have Sadie Miller as well as Sarah Jane Smith. It's absolutely brilliant way of elevating. But the Brigadier coming in, it just feels like it's all complete now. Which I remember listening, because I remember you in the pub sort of doing the Brigadier to in front of me. So I knew that they found the right person when they announced it. But hearing it all in a full 2-hour drama was just absolutely incredible.
That's very kind of you. That's very kind of you. It's the third Doctor adventures. You know, John Pertwee is a character I love to do.
Oh, absolutely.
And I love to voice, but it's also one that I love to hear done. And yes. I love the angle that that Tim Treloar comes at with it, where he does have that dash and that charm,
yes,
that turn of
yes.
pace, and also just hearing the rapport that. That he has with Katie Manning reprising Joe, timeless, wonderful Joe. And also it allows you to have that rivalry and friendship at the same time that the third Doctor and Brigadier have.
Yes, that sense of frustration, but also great, great trust. Yes, Doctor, what shall we do? What shall we do? you get all that energy mixed in there as well. Because we care
really...
about these characters. We do really care about them. And I've watched them all my life.
Mm.
So to play the Brigadier, you have to do it faithfully. Just exactly as Nicholas Courtney did it. Just exactly the way he created it. And to have the chance to just instinctively play that and for the Brigadier's character to be in new stories. With new characters, with doctors that he hasn't met before. To me, that feels like that feels like a very, very honourable thing to do for the characters. It shows.
Absolutely.
It shows that appetite for them is still there, and
they
go on in these new stories with these new characters. But you have to play it exactly as they do.
Oh, absolutely. I find that it's exactly the same with the Patrick Troughton stuff that I've done, is that it has to be that accurate. Not just necessarily, of course, as my voice developed, it got gradually a bit more improved, but in terms of the manner in which he speaks, the tone of the story around him and everything, you have to sort of capture that. Otherwise, it breaks that illusion, I think, in that sense. It becomes a bit like a sketch, which you don't want.
Yes, you don't want to exaggerate it in any way. You want to try and create the feeling that you felt when you first watched these characters.
Yes, yes. And I suppose in a sense, how does this compare with, of course, your work on Dead Ringers and so forth? Because you do go into voices very quickly. It's like a lightning connection in your head and you've got the voice right there, which is an amazing skill, which I'm completely envious of. It takes me a few goes. But how does this sort of compare? Because you're not doing just an impression for what would be a 2-minute sketch. It would be for a full drama. How did you find going from the sketch format to this sort of performance?
Well, the sketch is, a Dead Ringer sketch is a bit like a bank job. The writing is very heightened. You're in, you're out. Get the setup done, the misdirection in the middle, and then the sort of the punchline or the out of the sketch. You get in, you get out. It's all heightened. And it's hinged on humour. You want the shock of the laugh. And the exaggeration and the mickey take, which is a great, great fun thing to do. But in a drama, you're not aiming at a quick bit of exaggeration. You're just wanting to create that feeling.
Yeah.
You're just wanting to, you're aiming for truth rather than a punchline.
Yeah, of course.
And that's really where you're going. It's a chance in the dramas just to really settle down, stretch out, just let the story, let the character guide you through.
Yeah.
Rather than run on, launch your custard pie and get out before anyone spotted you.
When did you sort of first start to do the voice of the Brigadier?
Oh, my goodness. I think I've probably subconsciously, I think, done it for many years, probably from about 1983.
All right.
Yes, I always was there. I've watched The Five Doctors many, many times. And I think, and The Three Doctors too.
Mm.
I also think I became really familiar with the Brigadier's voice, Nicholas Courtney's voice, when Nick did the narration for the 1993 anniversary documentary, 30 Years in the TARDIS.
Oh, right, yes.
That's where Nick Courtney did the narration for that. And the voice was a little bit more conversational. And he would, yes, I spoke to William Hartley. He said, yes, you're with the wrong agent, Nick. I'll put it with mine. I didn't work for a year.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes, there we are, 30 years. Who would have thought it? Things come back to haunt you just when you least expect them. Nick was a little older at that time, 1993. And we were starting to get the tone of that voice, which was so full of that richness.
Yes.
The way his voice matures like a fine old whiskey. That was a lovely thing to play. And I drew on that quite a lot. One of the stories for Big Finish, written by Elizabeth Miles, a Seventh Doctor story.
Oh, yes.
The Grey Man of the Mountain.
That's it, yes.
And this was the Brigadier in around about the Battlefield story era, 1988, 1989. Mm. So I rewatched that documentary because there we have the Brig retired, a lot more experience, very much more reflective. Perhaps I wouldn't jump and judge quite so quickly as he would have done in the unit days. Yes, one learns to be more reflective when one has seen as many unusual things as I have. So the sense of him just sitting back by his fireside with a glass is something quite pleasant. There's so many different eras of him. Day of the Daleks is another story that I draw to. So many familiar phrases. When he's on the phone, "No, Mr. I do not propose to ignore the matter. In fact, I'm putting my best man on with him. In fact, I was just about to brief him when you rang." Some sort of ghost, apparently. He's quicker at that time.
Yes,
he's in the heart of his unit days, the heart of that military career.
Yeah.
He's pushing on. He's busting through walls, and he's at the height of his pace then. Later, yes, he will settle down. And it was interesting playing the Brig with the Ninth Doctor, with Christopher Eccleston's Doctor, because, you know, because of the pace that Chris Eccleston gives and the immediacy that he gives to the Ninth Doctor. To play the Brigadier in a sort of slower way, you couldn't really do that because the Ninth Doctor just lifts you.
He's so fast. He just keeps going so fast, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So it's that's fantastic. I need to hear more of that. So, yes, the Brigadier, he was taken to his pace. So once again, yes, I've never been at this speed for a long time. I've been far too old for this, Doctor.
Oh, fantastic.
I love that video clip you did, by the way, each doctor calling their successor to wish them luck. that was a beauty. That was a beauty.
I was quite impressed with that. The many of them I just did off the cuff. It wasn't any sense of, I thought, they're not going to go, not all of them are going to hit the mark, but here we go.
No, they did. All of them, they did.
Oh, thank you.
I thought, when I saw that, I thought, I'm not going to reply. I'm not going to type this message. I'm going to tell you personally next time I see you, because I believe in saying things personally rather than typing at times.
Oh, thank you.
That was fantastic. Love that.
Oh, thank you. I suppose something when it comes to playing characters, there's a lot of love for Nicholas Courtney and such, and there are some who probably are protective, like they are of John Pertwee or Patrick Troughton and all the various.
Did
you have that in your mind at all when like some people, what did you worry how it was going to, have any thoughts of how's this going to react with them at all?
Well, I can understand that feeling because I feel it myself.
Yes.
I feel very protective over these characters.
Mm.
And if you're going to portray them in new stories with new characters and keep that going, you've got to stay absolutely bang on faithful to it.
Absolutely.
And I do think that is doffing the cap to these characters.
Mm.
To me, I don't find that a disrespectful thing.
No.
I think it's a nod. It's an homage. It's raising your hat. Yes, I think it's something worth discussing.
Yeah, I always think it's more of a tribute as such. You're not replacing someone.
You would never want to do that.
No, which is what I can see what some people are skeptical of. I mean, talking to Jonathan Carley, for instance, there was it wasn't so long ago that John Hurt did leave us. So it was, and of course, a young man playing someone, well, I think about 40 years older than 40 years older than him. It was may or may not go down well, but it is important to remember, as some people I could see forget, is that we do our best to tribute these characters and sort of emulate them and almost continue in a what if sort of fashion. What if they, you know, they were doing these additional things?
Yes.
I've never seen that as a bad thing either.
No, I think it's, you know, certain responses like that, I think, are rather illogical, really. Mm. But I can understand them because I care about these characters too. You do feel protective of them yourself.
Yes, yeah.
Which is why I think you have a duty to play it as faithfully as possible.
Yes.
And I do think it is a great doffing of the cap. I imagine that for any actor to know that the character that they created is so memorable and so well-loved that everybody knows exactly what it is, who it is, and the energy of it, and to take that faithfully and to consider it with a sense of duty to continue to try to create that feeling.
Yeah.
To me, that's the ultimate raising of your hat.
Absolutely.
To those brilliant actors and the well-loved characters that they created.
Absolutely. Well, the reaction obviously was very, very positive to your performance anyway. So, you know, as I say, it is as though we are listening to Nicholas Courtney. So, you know, you've done the job well.
Thank you.
Does he have any sort of relatives who are still around, or anyone who's close to him at the time who've heard you or given their feedback to you?
I don't know. I do know that that the Haysman estate, who look after the character, they own the character and they look after the character.
Yeah.
I know that, you know, that they've always been very kind in what they've said.
Well, lovely.
And they've always been very, very kind and very, very complimentary, I'm happy to say, which gives you confidence.
Yes,
you know, that gives you a little bit of that gives you a little bit of buoyancy in your confidence with it.
Oh, good.
I know that much at least. The Haysman Estate have always been tremendously kind, for which I'm very, very grateful.
Mm.
And I think the moment you play any scene with them, any time I play the Brigadier, I can see him in my mind's eye.
Mm.
I can see the the moustache. I can see that hat. I can see those eyes full of that sense of duty.
Yes.
I'm really trying to make sense of the very unusual circumstances that always keep unfolding. Whenever the doctor's around, I just see it in my mind's eye.
Yes.
Particularly so. Because the Brigadier was watching Doctor Who when I was growing up. Various characters did remind me of members of my own family.
Oh, really?
John Pertwee was very like my own dad.
Oh.
They were born the same year. And they had a sort of a similar look in many ways. John Pertwee was in the Royal Navy and my dad was in the Royal Engineers.
Oh.
And the Brigadier was rather like my Uncle Richard.
Oh, right.
He's rather like your uncle, you know.
Mm.
Joe was like some of my sister's friends who would go to a disco in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And Benton and Captain Yates were a bit like my older brother and his mates. my own brother's 15 years older than me. So that they did remind me of my own family.
Oh, really?
When I was growing up. Yes, yes. I think that's, I'm sure many people felt very similarly.
Yeah, that's a really lovely way. I don't think I've ever had that, sadly. I don't think my parents have been that interesting for that. No offense to them. but the Pertwee era was the first era I really watched. When I was about
it.
When I was about probably 7 or 8, they had UK Gold used to put them on early in the morning, just after Blake 7.
Oh, yes.
And I'd get up every Sunday morning early just to watch them. And I saw them. And, so John Pertwee was my first Doctor, and that era sticks with me quite well. It's always sort of warms my heart every time I put that on. It's a nice nostalgic feeling. I need to try and sort of, I keep saying to myself, I'll put them on Sunday mornings. Now that my son wakes me up that early, I'll put them on Sunday mornings.
It's very true what you say. It really does generate that feeling.
Mm.
You know, John Pertwee gave the programme such a feeling of urgency.
Yes.
And excitement. And the way that, you really would be cowering behind the sofa at these alien creatures, the sea devils, I found terribly haunting and terrifying.
Mm.
And Bok, the little gargoyle, you can imagine him dashing up the stairs after you at night, the arms and everything like that. But just instantly, John Pertwee's Doctor, in the blink of an eye, knew exactly what to do. He would react, he would save the situation. And it was just so exciting, really was so exciting.
I was, funny enough, my son was, when he was a little younger, he was, we were trying to find ways of distracting him. And I ended up just putting on, I think, a John Pertwee Doctor Who, because he was so interested in different colours. So the moment he saw that the titles come on and John Pertwee's face and everything, he just sort of stared at it. Sort of was almost like he was comatose for about 25 minutes.
What a feeling that is.
Oh, it was a relief for me and his mum. But but he seems to quite enjoy it, actually. He likes that era more. When I put on a black and white Patrick Troughton, he's not that interested. But John Pertwee's always seems to be the way to calm him down at the moment, which is nice.
Yes, I can recall those feelings when I was watching it. Myself, I first watched the Pertwee era when I was 3 years old, as it was broadcast. And it's interesting you mentioning the UK Gold reruns there. That was very special for me to watch. I was in my early 20s then, and I was re-watching it for the first time.
Oh, really?
I thought that many years, perhaps, they'd been lost.
Mm.
There was no way to rewatch them, just the target novelizations and very rare repeats. And so to see them all again,
yes,
was very, very special, rewatching them for the first time. And now, of course, they're all brilliantly restored on DVD, and we have them all. We have them all whenever we wish.
Yeah. It's also nice that they're sort of bringing out the new box sets, really, because it's sort of, it's not, although it might be pleasurable for us, for those who know it, but it's, there are newer people now watching them, which is exciting, because they're now finding the same enjoyment in an era they might not have really given attention to because of its date, which was...
And it just shows how timeless the stories are.
Oh, yes.
How well they hold up. And as technology just reboots itself each time and each time.
Mm.
A great pal of mine is Paul Vanessis, who does a lot of the restoration work.
Oh, right, yes.
On these stories. And quite often we'll go for a curry and he will tell me how the restoration built up over many years. The Demons, for example.
Yeah.
That's one that's really been beautifully restored from...
Yeah.
The old black and white copies. And as technology through the 90s and early 2000s progressed, these extra layers of detail and brilliance in the restoration have all been added. And that will continue. It'll be just as if, it'll be just like, you know, detailed Blu-ray before very, very long. Beyond that, holographic,
yes.
Actual reality will come. And I'm looking forward to the restoration of Invasion of the Dinosaurs. I hope that that happens.
Oh, yes. I'd like to see
There's
what they
nice
do with
CGI
that.
CGI dinosaurs on there.
I would love the CGI dinosaurs. I put it on because, as I was saying, I was trying to entertain William. So Liz was sitting there watching it as well. I actually asked her, I said, which one would you like to pick out of the shelf? And she said, oh, let me pick, and chose Invasion of the Dinosaurs. And I said, okay. I'm going to tell you, it's a brilliant story, but you might laugh on the odd occasion. And you're sort of looking at the cheapest Ray Harryhausen sort of model effects, which, did they work at the time you saw them? Or would anyone see them?
That they might have done if they were toys you had in the bath.
it's not like Jurassic Park, is it?
Yes, exactly. How old was that? So what was I when that was in 1973? I'd have been 5 years old. And I didn't mind at the time.
No, you wouldn't have lied.
Through my five-year-old eyes, they were fine. They were just dinosaurs.
Yeah.
They were like the ones I played with, and just, you know, seeing John Pertwee looking up, great awe of these creatures. That was quite remarkable. So no, I didn't mind. I'd love to see technology fix that one.
Oh, absolutely. On the subject there, we got a glimpse there of your John Pertwee impression. You have done the John Pertwee impression quite in a few different projects over the years as well, haven't you?
Yes. Yes, Scourge of the Cybermen, most recently, and Terror of the Master.
Oh, yes,
Those audio novels.
I did like how they managed, was it Masterful? Masterful. Yeah, you had a chance to use that then. I suppose it was their way of not treading on Tim Treloar's toes for a moment, which was quite nice as well.
Yes, well, it's we each have our own way of doing it, you know. And whenever we meet, we'll always have a little comparison and talk about different things that we've noticed. Yes, in that story, I think it was Chameleon.
That's
Chameleon
it, yeah.
was walking alongside Joe for a little while, and then it went from that robotic voice and then a very slowly sort of transmogrified into the Third Doctor. So that Joe would be reassured, you see.
Yeah, of course.
That's right. I love those... Those subtle things that the Third Doctor says.
Yes.
Which made him so very paternal and
yes.
so full of warmth.
Mm.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
That's right. You know, those sorts of things just made you feel so protected by this heroic wizard.
Yes. And you mentioned they're chameleons, so that's another character you've also been brought into play. So how did that come about as such? And did you base it on the original chameleon at all? Or?
Chameleon I based in the first story, in the first of the Fifth Doctor adventures, where Chameleon comes back, and it's all leading to one of those wonderful things that Big Finish does, which fills in gaps, gives you the backstory for characters where that didn't take place necessarily on TV.
Yes.
You do have that chance to go into beautiful depth.
Mm.
So for the first few scenes of Chameleon, I based it on how I'd seen Chameleon speaking in The King's Demons.
Yes.
That Gerald Flood, kingly character.
Yeah.
For a while, we just had that in there. But then I thought that Chameleon would probably, in his robotic way, would gradually return to the default position. What his neutral program was when he wasn't being a chameleon to any other character or voice.
Very good, yeah.
So I thought he'd go back to a neutral position. And I just looked at that face, really.
Mm.
That very benevolent face of Chameleon.
Yeah.
It's beautifully robotic in an 80s way, but it's got real character.
Yes.
An expression. And I can imagine Chameleon being a drinking buddy of C-3PO. I think they meet up in some spaceport and put the world to rights.
Yes, yeah.
I wonder if C-3PO just mentors Chameleon a little bit. Oh, please, try not to be so easily led, Mr. Chameleon. I care about you far too much as my friend. And just looking at Chameleon's face, very benevolent, it felt to me as though he probably would speak in this sort of way.
Yes.
Quite robotic and at that sort of pace. But something, this sound just seems to match the eyes.
Yes, and yeah.
That was how I imagined it, really.
Oh, right.
It'd be lovely to see Chameleon back in the TV show. You can just imagine now that it could be realised technologically.
Yes.
And, you know, you've not got a gear stick and a car battery, which means you're not able to do very much, whatever they use. Yeah. You know, it's testament to how great Peter Davison's performance was with Chameleon in the way that he would look at that robot.
Oh,
dead in the eye.
You believed it, yeah.
Yeah, and Peter did that. But it'd be very interesting to see Chameleon back again now. Now that technology could allow him to do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so many possibilities.
Mm. Oh, that's brilliant. And, on a side note of another real-life person you did play, and very well, I might add, is you did... it's not Doctor Who related, but David Bowie.
Oh, yes. Yes, the final take. Bowie in the studio. That was an immense privilege and fascinating to play Bowie. Written by a great, great Bowie fan and radio producer, a fellow called David Morley, who's got encyclopedic knowledge of Bowie. And directed by Dirk Maggs.
Yes.
Who is fantastic at making audio movies, really. And he's doing that so prolifically and brilliantly with Sandman at the moment, as written by Neil Gaiman.
Oh, yes, of course.
And that was directed by Dirk Maggs. And with David Morley's writing and Dirk Maggs' direction, I was able to, that was a big help to me. That,
yeah.
I remember listening to this, documentary called Verbatim, where David Bowie was very relaxed and very just chatty about all of the different things that have that have inspired him through his career, from early '60s. You know, I liked Sir Little Richard, and Presley. I think I was very. The way that I would see people reacting and responding when Presley was played, and the way it just made them dance. That was just one of those things where I thought, I want to do that.
Yeah.
He's just got such... I love the speed at which his ideas come to life. And that beautiful blend of humility and brilliance, and just being a almost like a wow, almost like a prophet, really.
Yeah,
I love that interview you did on Newsnight with Jeremy Paxman. This is around about 1999. I don't think we haven't scraped the surface of the possibilities of the internet, both good and bad.
Yeah.
It's just going to change everything. It is going to change everything. We haven't. It's an alien life form. I love the way Bowie sort of talks and laughs at the same time. That's a nice quality that he has there.
Yeah.
Always looking up. He's always looking up as he's talking because the ideas are going. That inventiveness, those ideas, constantly, all the time. And it's just lovely to immerse. One walks a little taller when yes. you have to portray people such as this. It's amazing.
Are there any real life people you've wanted to bring to life in a sort, in a similar sort of way? Is there any like voice or anything?
Oh my goodness! My goodness! My goodness! I think anybody with an intriguing story recently, really. I recently played Alan Wicker.
Oh yes.
In honor of his centenary, and there's an interesting character. You see, his voice so distinctive.
Mm.
It's very easy just to go into full impression mode with that, but you can't, you see.
Yeah, yeah.
In a drama, you have to keep it very realistic. Of course, the piece-to-camera type voice in this sort of way is a little more familiar, and you hold the roving microphone sort of halfway up your chest like that, and immediately, there it is. But there's also a very charming way that Alan Wicker would talk conversationally. Where it was much more relaxed, and it would be somewhere around here. All the best journeys in the world always start at Victoria Station. So this morning I'm saying, start the world, I want to get on.
because that's the tricky part, is trying to... How do you find going from just, if there's a voice and you've got the impression there, you can do... And then how do you... What's your process of sort of expanding on that? Do you sort of come on, because I sometimes find a key phrase and then sort of try and drag it on the tone along as best I can.
Yes, those are the first moments of just putting the scaffolding up,
yeah.
If you like. The sound of the voice is the top coat.
Yeah.
That's the varnish, really. That's just the detail.
Yes.
Below that, you've just got to try to evoke the feeling and the energy that they bring.
Mm.
And I think that's what it is. Not just about what you see and hear, but about what you feel.
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. And
those are the ingredients of the cake.
Yes.
That's the eggs, flour and water of the cake. You know, what you feel.
Mm.
And what you see and hear is the final little accent, the final little varnish on the top.
Yeah, because I find it's, even if I can't nail the voice straight away, in my mind, I know the mannerism. You can do the mannerism. You could said, oh, okay, the voice is exactly spot on, but you could identify just kind of what they behave like. I suppose I think I remember you saying like with like Ricky Gervais, for example, when you do an impression of Ricky Gervais, you've got that David Brent sort of physique in your head already before the voice even comes to you.
Yeah, you know, bobbing around, okay. Yeah. What I very Oh, okay, a word coming. What a very perspicacious observation.
I do love that video of you doing it next to him as well.
It's at Radio 5 Love. I had no idea he was going to be there. I was very innocently going in to plug the impression show that me and Deborah Stevenson did. There was Ricky Gervais sat there, okay? And best of all, okay, he was sat by the wall and I was next to him, so he was cornered, yeah? couldn't get away, okay?
Oh. Well, he seemed to enjoy it at the time. He certainly enjoyed it.
It was great fun. I always come from a benevolent place.
Anyway. Yeah, yeah. Is there any time you've ever done the voice where someone's not been impressed? Not necessarily impressed. They're sort of like, ah, right, okay. You know, sort of a hubert sort of thing.
I'm trying to think. Eamon Holmes got a little bit... we did five sketches as him on the Impression Show. And I think his patience lasted for three. It was a bit surreal and over the top. But, you know, once again, you know,
yeah,
we were soon laughing about it.
Absolutely.
I went up... it was the Trick Awards a few months after. And
yeah.
I said, oh, sorry about that. Sorry, we didn't mean to make you feel like that. And he goes, oh, there he is now, right? There is the word I can't broadcast, so I can't. So we were laughing about it very, very quickly.
Oh, you know, brilliant.
Very, very quickly. So, you know, that was fine. And, you know, he encourages me to do it now. I don't say so it is, so I don't. I don't say that, but it sounds right when you say it, so it does. So I'm going to say it who I am.
Because I remember, I had to share it. I shared it recently. It was about 6 years ago. We went to the TARDIS. We won through a competition. Well, my friend did, invited me along.
Fabulous.
And we went to the actual TARDIS set in Cardiff. And Peter Capaldi would then come up and he met everyone there. And there was about five groups. What? Some were just their friends. Some, but then you got the innocent one. Someone brought their wife and kids along. I didn't know at the time that my friend recorded this. I thought he was taking a photo, but he put me on the spot just saying, by the way, this is Chris. He does a voice in my video. And before it, and then so he goes, oh, go on, I'll give you a bit of my voice. And the moment I was standing next to him, I don't think I looked him in the eye. I was so sort of starstruck and nervous at this point that I just couldn't look at him.
What a thing for your mate to do to you. What
I
a
know.
Position to put you in. You wouldn't be able to look in the eye because it would have been too distracting, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You just need to turn away, concentrate, channel your own thoughts and just deliver it. So, yeah.
So I said, well, I could do my best here, you know, or something like that. And then he was, oh, very good, you know, turns to me. And but it wasn't until afterwards, because it's so over and quite quick, because obviously he's got everyone to see. So you only get your few, like 30 seconds with it, like you would do at a convention, I suppose. And it wasn't until afterwards that he showed, said, I recorded this, it's on your phone. And I had to look and I was wondering. It wasn't until watching the video back that I actually noticed in pausing it and sort of doing, almost like I was decoding the video, he did enjoy the impression, which was, so for about an hour before I looked at the video, I thought, oh my God, I've embarrassed myself. I still maintain it's the worst attempt at the voice I've ever done of him. And but he seemed to enjoy it.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was fantastic. Oh. I'm sure that's just your humility speaking. It would be very distracting when they're right there in front of you. You know.
Did you ever? Well, I know you've done Tom Baker to Tom Baker because that was on a very quite. What program was that? It was. It was before
Alter Ego. Yes, Alter Ego.
Alter Ego. That's it.
That was done in the year. What was it now? 2000, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember
the Restless Pub in Highgate, and it was very interesting that show. It was very interesting the people who we invited, who said yes, who were quite fascinated by it. And Chris Tarrant agreed to come on. Dale Winton did, Patrick Moore, and Tom Baker.
Oh, brilliant!
So it was all wonderful, avuncular characters. And I watched it. I watch it back now, and I was so, you know, inexperienced then. So inexperienced. You're just hoping you'll get by as best you can.
Yeah.
But it was huge, huge fun. And Tom was very. yes, he was at the full power of his eccentricity. sort of sitting there in the Restless Pub, and. He would say, what's my attitude here? Well, how should I feel whilst being presented? You know, in, here you are in front of me. What's my attitude? I sort of said, mild surprise, merry bemusement, but perhaps also feeling that you've met a long-lost ally.
or rather like my comforted to meet my mischievous twin. Yes, all right. Yes, okay. Right, yes, okay, yes. Right, well, let's do that, and then I'll, yes, we can have a pint of bitter. Yes.
And just, he's such a force of nature, is Tom, isn't he? Such a beautiful, ever-giving eccentricity.
Yes, yeah.
Flamboyance. Amazing, amazing.
So I'm back to, of course, the Nicholas Courtney and so on. So are there, but obviously I won't ask you to spoil anything that is coming up, but there are plans ahead for more of the Brigadier, I'm assuming.
Yes, there are some that I've recorded years ago, which are yet to come out. And yeah, there are more tales.
Oh, fantastic.
More tales to come. And hopefully more doctors to meet and all of that.
I'd love to hear another, see like a Patrick Troughton, a second Doctor story again, something after Invasion or something.
Yes, yes. That was a nice time. He was Colonel Lethbridge Stewart then, wasn't he?
I think by Invasion, he became Brigadier.
Yes, must have had a very efficient time, very efficient time.
The thing I love about the Brigadier is he's a brilliant character. Many points that you've raised emulate what I think of, but I do find him quite hilarious in a sense, because he goes from this. Well, first of all, when you first see him in the Web of Fear, he's a very he's just a military man who's sort of just he's like in an impossible, weird situation with Yetis in the underground, has given up on the point of contesting that these monsters exist and just gone, okay, now what are we going to do about it? You know, that sort of attitude. Then, of course, he's very much open to the idea of it. But then as the series progresses, I find he then goes, oh, you must be joking.
Yeah, that's another part of how beautifully Nicholas Courtney created the character. Because you can't have the sense of military duty, but also that very... grave sense of emergency. They are, Miss Shaw. They are. This planet has been attacked by alien forces on several occasions. We were lucky enough to be able to stop them. He's got that urgency.
Yeah.
But of course, when things get completely balmy, it's probably chroma. Some damn full flute. Those levels to go to as well.
I always find that amusing. Out of all the stuff that he has seen throughout his career so far, which would have been ridiculous, and suddenly the whole building beaming goes, oh, come now, that's too far.
Yes, I think all various adventures did perhaps push him closer to that, but not to the point beyond it. He was able to absorb it, make sense of it, and take it forward to the next story, the next situation, where... his resilience towards the unbelievable had deepened that a little bit more.
Yeah.
So, yes, he was able to take it on board very strongly.
It's very much almost like he goes through sort of that midlife crisis moment at that point, because afterwards, as you say, he does settle down and he's very much back to how he used to. He goes, oh, things I've seen and so on. I think he's absolutely brilliant. Well, I'm glad they, you know, Big Finish are allowing him to continue, and through yourself as well. And glad to see there's more coming there. Hope the second Doctor does come across. And
oh yes, I always marvel at your second Doctor. It's one of my favourite voices that anybody does.
Oh, thank you.
That anybody does. And I love how you describe the way that you built it up with the little coughs and the and those hesitations. Yeah.
It jolts me back into the voice. So if I'm starting to lose my way a bit, right, there we are, back into it. It just keeps it going.
Oh, that's gorgeous. That's gorgeous. There is a difference, isn't there?
Yes.
Between the 60s Troughton and
the
Five Doctors era. Because when I've had to do the audiobooks and so on, Five Doctors, for example, and I was very, very haunted by your Troughton when I was delivering those lines, but oh dear, Oh, we could be playing the game of Rassilon at this very moment. There's a softness to that era, isn't there?
Yes.
Which I think sort of, I decided to latch onto that.
Yeah.
To sort of try to be truer to that era, but also to be different to yours.
So I'm flattered that you took me as a sort of a basis, I suppose. That's quite nice.
No.
With Troughton, he starts off, you know, when he's in the, like, the power of darkness, he says, did little damage, did I? You know, he's very, very different and sort of things like that. And obviously then later along, the best fun I've had playing, doing it is trying to do Salamander. Because yes. it's not just his voice, it's a bit of a difference. You know, it's all VR. And someone pointed out he sounds like a waiter in that. You can imagine Salamander's restaurant. He goes, what's that, table for two? Come on, sit down, my friend, sit down. I'll get your wings. They're hotter than the sun. You know, that sort of thing.
Do you know, I wonder if Patrick based that character on somebody he really met. It's just reminded me of David Graham, who, of course, played Parker in Thunderbirds.
Mm.
And a wine waiter served him and Gerry Anderson one day and gave him the voice of Parker. Would you like to see the wine menu, sir? Would you like to see the wine? So I wonder if Patrick Troughton met some character in real life which gave him a steer to Salamander. I wonder.
It must be. It's like, there are many voices, like, for instance, Paul Whitehouse in The Far Show, based, like, the famous Rowley Birkin QC on I think somebody met on a fishing trip or something like that. I'm sure it's something like that. But it's amazing where some of these voices come from. Because I work, my other job I do is working on in a sort of a call center capacity. So you speak to a lot of people and then there's someone who comes along with a voice that you just, that's brilliant. that's going to turn up in a drama one day. I'll pencil that down.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Is it tempting to answer them back in their own tone?
It's sometimes with accents, yes. I'm actually quite disappointed some of them. We've called out to, because sometimes we have to call out to some people and for whatever reason. Not really a necessary cold call, usually returning a call or something. And if it's someone out in Australia or New Zealand, they're not Australian or New Zealand, just a British citizen who's moved out there. So when they answer, go, hello, you know, I'm like, oh, I was really spoiled there, mate. I was really hoping you were going to entertain me, but never mind.
We might have had some way of collaborating. But, you sound like my Uncle Dave.
It's good of fun. I think that's all we have time for, really. It's coming up to the hour there, but well, thank you, John, for joining me on that.
Speaking for 3 days now. Of course, it doesn't seem that long. It seems almost like 30 minutes, really. But yes.
No,
yes.
Of course. It certainly will be a pleasure to work with you again. We did our...
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
Yes, because we did do our Parkinson Patrick Troughton interview some years ago as well. That was good fun.
Now, I wonder where we can... I wonder what we can... Let's make it our duty to invent something. Yes. Let's invent a project and come up with something there.
Yes.
Yes, I wonder if it's Nick Courtney and Patrick Troughton in the TQ. I wonder if it's that. I wonder. Yes, we'll see. We'll see.
Well, thank you very much for joining me, John.
It is my pleasure, Chris. Thank you so much. And thank you for listening to my inane drivel.
And wasn't that a delightful chat? John has always been such a lovely man, and I'm really grateful he came on the show. If you are interested in purchasing any of the audios that John is in, please go to bigfinish.com, and thank you to them for the clip. And that concludes this episode. However, we will be back for the final episode in this season. But don't worry, we will be back for another season in the new year with some new guests. But our final guest of this season is someone I've wanted to get on the show from the very beginning, and thankfully she said yes, and I cannot wait to show you all. It's Sadie Miller. We'll see you then. Take care.